And what I'll share is just my experience, and I guess the proviso and all that is that it's not necessarily the right experience, but it's just mine. And if I say anything that doesn't sound quite right with your sponsor or your home group or your counselor, go with them. Trust me, go with them. And my goal tonight is, I was going to say it's kind of small, but really it's a big goal. If I can just say one thing that helps one person, I'll be good. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on what it was like. I'll give you the kind of the quick rundown, real quick. I was born in 60, just turned 50 years old last month. I came to Ridgeview when I was 40 in November of 2000. And 8 days, I'll have 9.5 years. And but who's counting, right? But I'll just say I know we've all got a story, and mine's probably not a lot different. But I'll try to give the quick summary of it. And I'm looking at my notes I've got here. In one of the counseling sessions, it says, develop a timeline to indicate the progress of my addiction and the resulting areas of my life that were consequently impacted. And I did it pretty succinctly. And so I'm just going to kind of work off of this to try to get through some of it quickly. But between 1960 and 1972, when I was 12, I moved 13 times with my parents. My parents were 17 and 18 when I was born, and they were the first kids in their families to try to go to college and get a college education. And they obviously didn't know what they were doing by having a baby at that age. And we moved 13 times to various places, you know, around the South. I'm from Nashville, by the way. I live in Nashville. And so there was kind of a lack of stability, I think, growing up there in my earliest years. And my parents were in school. They both worked. They worked their way through school. And, you know, it was juggling the kids and trying to put their life together because they were just kids. And I think as a consequence of that, you know, I probably missed out on some of my emotional needs as a young kid. I'm the oldest of three, sister 3 years younger and brother 5 years younger. And they had all three of us by the time my father was in law school. So it all happened pretty quick, and then as being the oldest, you know, I got to kind of do what I wanted. But I didn't have a lot of consistency in family and friends and just where I was. And so I kind of found myself always seeking approval, that kind of thing, and wanting to be a part of. In 1972, from 72 to 78, from 12 years old to finishing high school, a lot happened. I started smoking pot when I was 12, and had my first drink when I was 12, and I liked it a lot. It quickly progressed. I liked it so much that, you know, I didn't want to pay for it, so I did things to have to not pay for it. that were illegal, if you know what I mean. And I, you know, I notice here it says, you know, legal, you know, I broke the law, health, it implicated my health back then at an early age because I kind of dropped out of one sport after another. I was very athletic when I was a kid and I kind of dropped out of all that. Impacted my family. I was caught several times with pot, drugs, alcohol. I got busted when I was 18, actually, very disappointing to the family. And at that point, you know, I had no really, being the oldest of three, you know, and by that time my father's career was taking off and he was gone more and more. And so I kind of just did what I wanted, you know, from the time I could ride a bike at 12, I mean, I was going everywhere. And I had a good time, you know, probably too good of a time, but I probably could have found these rooms even back then, now that I look back on it. After high school, my disease, which I didn't know I had then, continued to progress. I had no drive in college. All I wanted to do was chase girls and have a good time. I mean, and that's what I did, and I was successful at doing that, but I was wasting my time, my parents' money at the time. I remember going home one day and asking my dad for, I think back then it was like $200 for a meal ticket for the first semester, and I went and bought a half pound of pot. And, you know, I just thought that was just okay. I mean, you know, that was no big deal. But looking back on it, that was just kind of a crazy. I continued to break the law more and more. And through those actions, contributed to other people's use and addictions. And to be accepted, I actually used IV drugs too. Back then, I guess I was probably about 20, and I contracted hepatitis C at the time, and I was very sick for a good while there. And you know, it was funny. I went to the doctor. I was like yellow, and I couldn't get out of bed. Really, I mean, I could barely get around. And he did these tests on me, and he came back, and he just said, you know, it was like he was ashamed of what was going on with me because he didn't even tell me what I had. At the time, I don't think they identified it as hepatitis C. I think there were, I can't recall, but he just said there was nothing he could do about it and that I'd probably get to feeling better, and I did eventually. But that was a serious health-related consequence that I had. It got to the point to where I tried to make a geographic change. I was in over my head with people that were well over my head and people that I, wrong people, the wrong kind of people that I looked up to back then, I think in an effort to find a father figure. I was in over my head and I owed a lot of money, and I decided to make a geographic change in about 82. I went to Texas and, you know, swore it off. By this time, cocaine and marijuana were the primary things, and that's what eventually caused most of my problems. But went to Texas and was down there for, you know, a couple of months, and it found me again, and I was back to doing the same things down there. And the geographic change didn't work. In 1986 to 1992, I was single and just involved and engaged in a lot of dangerous activities back then. My use escalated. In some ways, I found the desire to go back to college. You know, I decided I wanted to go back to school. I was about 25, and started making some changes to make that happen. And in 1985, I actually married a bartender, and for the wrong reasons too. I've done that a couple of times. You know, I was living with this girl, and I was out one night, and I was unfaithful to her, and I came back and felt so guilty about it that I asked her to marry me. Needless to say, that didn't last very long, probably about a year or so. I don't know what that was all about. Codependency issues, I think, that were just really grabbing a hold of me at that time in my life. And I eventually got back to school. We divorced. I went back to school, and I borrowed a lot of money and wouldn't ask anybody for help at that time. I wanted to try to prove myself, and it was a good time. My use sort of went down, and I did a lot of good work in a short time, and then I decided, well, what am I going to do, you know, 29 years old with a political science degree? You know, I'll be sacking groceries down here with the other poli-sci majors. So I decided I'd just go on to law school, because there's kind of a history of lawyers in my family, and that was a natural progression. That was maybe the most important and best piece of advice I got from my dad, as I was talking to him about it. And I was like, but Dad, you know, I'll be 32 years old when I get out of law school. And he said, well, son, you're going to be 32 anyway. So I was like, do you want to have a law degree or not? You know, it's pretty simple. And it made a lot of sense. So I went down there, and of course, I lacked confidence, low self-esteem, lacked confidence in what I was doing. I was, first year law school was just no fun. And I was lonely, and all the women in law school seemed like total bitches, you know. And I know that's not true now, it was just me, but this girl I'd been dating, I just decided to ask her to marry me, and for her to move down with me, and so I wouldn't be alone anymore. And she did, and I have two wonderful kids as a result of that marriage. But while I was in law school, you know, I remember seriously thinking, as I'm moving from Nashville to Memphis, I was like, well, if I'm going to be a lawyer, I probably ought to stop breaking the law. It was one of those spiritual awakenings I had at the time. And so I tried to. I stopped using. I stopped doing illegal activities. You know, I still drink a little bit, but I was really kind of paranoid about making it in law school. You know, I wanted to make it. And by the time, you know, that first semester, I was so stressed out. You know, I was so stressed out. I just threw in the towel. You know, it was like, just give me some relief. And marijuana is my drug of choice. I mean, if you lined it all up and said I could have only one thing, that's what I would pick. And And for you other potheads out there, you know, it's just a big lie. Marijuana is just a big lie. But I found that, and shortly after that, of course, you know, the cocaine came back around, and you know, it was just all kind of, I was just doing it all again while I was in law school. In 92, I finished law school, moved back to Nashville, my son was born, and I started studying for the bar exam, and I was thinking about, you know, thinking about this lifespan, you know, preparing for this, and I can remember, so sad for me to think about it, you know, doing, you know, being on cocaine, studying for my bar exam with my brand new baby in my arm. And, you know, it's just, it's a miracle. I mean, it's just a miracle that we're all here, really, that we're not out there. But, you know, and that sort of thing continued with my kids some. I mean, as they grew older, I continued, I'll just mention this, you know, I continued to do things not in front of, but around my kids that I didn't think were wrong at the time, you know. I would drive around with several things in my glove compartment. You know, if I wanted to use something and we were driving somewhere, I'd just pull over and get out of the car and use real quick and get back in and keep driving. I just, you know, I wasn't one of those binge people that, you know, you put a, like my buddy Phil sitting out here, he's the binger. And Sam's got a room for you, Phil. But I was one that wanted just to kind of stay on something all the time, 24/7, just when I was awake, all the time. And so that was very misleading and deceptive to me and to my way of thinking about addiction when I got here. You know, it's because of the way I used, you know. I was that kind of user, not this kind of user. And but I know different now. Started practicing law and then got involved in a political campaign, and had a blast. I traveled around, traveled the state, and did a lot of public speaking, and met a lot of great people, a lot of politicians, met a lot of lobbyists and people that are involved in political process, and you know, it was a lot of fundraisers and a lot of drinking and social activity, you know. And I thrived in that environment, and especially when I had a little bottle of something, you know, in my pocket that I could step in the men's room or whatever, and I just keep drinking all night, you know. And but I met all these lobbyists, and I started kind of figuring out, you know, these guys, they go around, they go to fundraisers, they go to dinners, they drink a lot, they play golf a lot. And I was like, I want to be a lobbyist. That sounds good, you know. And because the lawyer thing just, it didn't work out quite well enough for the sloth, you know, that I have. And that was very appealing to me, and so that kind of became my goal. After the campaign was over, I sought out a firm that was opening an office in Nashville, and went to them and pitched my idea, and they hired me on, and I started lobbying in 1995, and practicing law too at the firm, and my goal was to eventually, you know, be like this other lobbyist I knew who had his own lobbying firm, and he you know, he spent all of Florida, I mean, all of the summer in Florida, and, you know, January to June in Nashville working at the Capitol. And I told Cleve one day, I was like, Cleve, I want to be like you when I grow up. And he said, well, obviously you don't want to grow up, you know. And there's a whole lot of truth to that, a whole lot of truth to that. But during that time, my sister, who'd been struggling with pain pill addiction, had really gotten herself in a bad way. And we did an intervention on her and took her to a place up there called Cumberland Heights. She fought it, but my mother, my brother, and I were there for her family week. And during that time, you know, I was exposed to some things that I'd never really been exposed to. And one of the things, you know, was this idea of codependency and dysfunctional families and how all that relates and the different roles we play. Anyway, I came home one day, I think I smoked some pot, you know, and I was all depressed, and I was like, you know, I think I figured out what's wrong with me, you know, I'm codependent, you know, I kind of read about that for about a week, and then moved on. In 95, my daughter Rachel was born, and that's when I started doing this lobbying thing. And so the big thing, you know, was now that I'm going to be a lobbyist, I got to build relationships. It's all about relationships. And so it like worked perfectly with my plan, because when they come to town Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday nights, you know, at night, that's when all the activity takes place. And so we would, and the laws were different then, and so we'd be out every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday night drinking and eating and drinking and drinking. And I was also going to the bathroom, and, you know, because these guys could really drink. And I was having to have a little helper with that. But I was out late at night, and it was a strain on my marriage. And I remember, you know, that I started lying to my wife about my use, and that became problematic, and for her. And the flash forward was we separated. When we separated, that's when I started my downward spiral, because I felt so bad and so guilty about what I thought I was doing to my kids, who were five, and, well, they were almost five and almost eight. And I really spiraled out of control. My typical day was, you know, get up, do cocaine, go to work, do enough of that to keep myself going, looking forward to happy hour, go out to happy hour, not make it home or even to bed sometimes until 3 or 4 in the morning, then get up again about 7 and do the same thing again. And that's what I did. And I remember feeling so guilty and so bad about what I thought I was doing to my kids. And I remember being out in bars and just looking at my phone and thinking, it's after 9 o'clock, I can't call my kids, and, you know, I forgot to call them before 9 o'clock. And I would just beat myself up for that. You know, it just really hurt me. That's when I kind of got out of control. So at this point, you know, on the outside, I'm looking pretty good, actually. You know, I've got money in my pocket. I'm not having to sell drugs to have drugs anymore. I can buy my own. And I you know, I look pretty good on the outside in terms of the way I'm dressed and what I'm doing for a living and how I behave during the day and night even. It's like our old buddy Dwight in treatment. He used to be the sharpest black guy I was in treatment with. He was just sharp-dressed man all the time. You know, we'd be sitting around in our pajamas and Birkenstocks, and I say, Dwight, man, you sure look sharp. He said, man, I ain't nothing but a dressed-up trash can. And that's exactly what I was and what I can be now. I just try to keep the can empty today. But I had become pretty much an egomaniac with an inferiority complex at this point, and just thought I was above it all. And my use was just like I described that one day. And my sister, at a party my brother had, my sister began to notice me and pay attention. Of course, she's got the bug. She had the bug, and so she, you know, when you got it, you can spot it. And she started trying to convince my other family members that I had a problem, and, you know, nobody thought I did. I was even living with my dad temporarily. He traveled a lot, and they just couldn't believe that, you know, that I had a problem. And they all started watching me closely and decided that I did have a problem. And after a long night of doing what I did, I remember on November 21st, 2000, I got up that morning, I did the drugs I did, I got my suit and tie on, I went to my daughter's elementary school to watch her in a play, and did more on the way over there, came out, did more in the car, was in the car driving downtown to the office, and I got a phone call about a meeting that some folks wanted me to come by. And I just knew. I knew what that was. I knew that my time had come. And I went to the meeting anyway, and I walked in. It was my family. They said, I just stopped them. I said, what do you want me to do? They said, we want you to go down here to this place in Atlanta. I said, all right. When you want me to go? They said, right now. I said, okay. And so at that point, I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with the marijuana and the Valiums and the Xanax and the cocaine and the mushrooms. And what I did, I got my sister to go with me, and I had to go by my office and pay some bills and all that, and when we were coming back, I was a heavy smoker at the time, and I was like, she's like, you better get you a carton of cigarettes. I said, okay, you know, would you run in and get it while I make some calls? And so I get out and I grab all my stuff and I stuff it down the bottom of my golf bag in the back of my Jeep at the time, and so I stashed it, and then I packed up, drove down here. We got down here, and when we got here, it was my father, my brother, and me. And they said we were coming down here for a 28-day treatment program. And we got here, and that's what they thought. That's what they thought. And so we got here, and we met with Dr. Early at the time, and they were talking about, you know, we're 28 days and all this, and Dr. Early was like, you know, 28 days, yeah. And there was no 28 days, and they both looked at me like, you know, we're sorry. We're sorry, man. We thought it was 28 days, and there was no days. It was just kind of like whenever. And so they let me here, but, you know, the thing that was really attractive to me was because I got to come down to the professional program, you know, And for the special people, you know, that, and so when I got here, I remember, you know, checking in. I was coming to the professional program. I had my laptop. I got to hurry up. My cell phone. And they took it all away. You know, they took everything away from me. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. I thought I'd just catch up on emails, you know, between things and that kind of thing. And anyway, they checked me in. I remember they were asking me these questions, you know, over at Cottage Cheese, and asking me all these questions, and I was being honest. For the first time, I was being honest. I was telling her, you know, I was telling them everything I did, how much I used, all, you know, my whole history. And I was being honest, and they said, ever had any blackouts? And I said, no, never had any blackouts. They said, you never not remembered what you did the night before? I said, oh, that's a blackout. I didn't know. I didn't know that was a blackout. It's like, yeah, I checked that one too. I had blackouts. And I remember I was seriously trying to figure out, you know, if I needed to be here. And it was... the laughter is what happened. You know, we'd be in the meetings, and, you know, from day one, you're doing the 12-step meetings or the group thing, the men's group, women's group, and, you know, I'm Susie, I'm an addict, I'm Tommy, I'm an alcoholic, I'm, you know, Billy, I'm an alcoholic, and they'd come to me, and I'd say, I'm Tony, and I'm here to find out if I have a drug problem, and everybody would laugh, and they'd say, we can tell you, man, look where you are, you know? And you know, I didn't get it. I didn't get that at that time. I was serious. I was serious about that, you know? I wanted to really find out because I wasn't sure. I just knew that I was miserable, you know? I was miserable on the inside. And finally, you know, I can remember getting on my knees, for you all that are patients here, I remember being in my room, being by myself, and trying to really read the things that they gave me. The NA book in particular, I remember, is what helped me in the very beginning, and asked myself those questions, honest questions, and answer them honestly to myself, you know, in the privacy of my own room. And I, when I looked at those things, I started to realize that, you know, maybe, just maybe, I'm at the right place. And and you know, I finally, the whole powerlessness thing really was a problem for me. And I backed my way into the first step by looking at my life and thinking that my life was unmanageable, in the sense that it hadn't gone exactly the way, it was okay, but it hadn't gone exactly the way I would have liked for it to have gone. And for the time being, I accepted the powerlessness part. And, you know, it was a big relief to finally take that first step and admit in the beginning that I was an addict. Today I know that that's addict, alcoholic, alcoholic, addict, whatever. It's all universal to me. But I guess the true me is an addict, and to alcohol and everything else. But I know I wouldn't be standing here today if it wasn't for the things that I learned when I was here. And the things that I heard in the meetings where people from outside would come in, and you know, I would hear people talk about relapsing and using again, and they'd say, well, I got a sponsor, but then I stopped calling him, or I never called him, and I got a sponsor, I called him, but I never did anything else, and I got a sponsor, I called him, we started working on the steps, I quit at step 3, you know. started working the steps, got to step four, I left some stuff out of step four. And I stopped going to meetings. Started isolating. It's all the things that I heard and I paid attention because I wanted to try to stay sober one day at a time. And they were telling me things like, you know, do 90 and 90 when you get out. And get a sponsor and get a temporary sponsor. And that's when I met Susan and met Bill. And I spent my first sober Thanksgiving here in 2000. By the time, and let me tell you, this whole time I was here, I'm thinking, well, what about that stuff up there in my golf bag? And I'm sharing this because one of y'all might have something in your golf bag, you know? I thought about it a lot. And I thought, you know, well, I'll just sell it to my buddy over here and get my money back. And then I was like, oh, I don't want to do that because then I'll be contributing to his problem, you know? Well, I'll just flush it, you know, and I finally decided I was going to flush it all except the pot, and I was going to take that and put it in some container and go bury it somewhere, and maybe in a year or two, just go out and smoke a little, you know, that's kind of what I was thinking, and by the time Christmas came around, I got to go home on a pass, and I went back to Nashville. And I had a ride up there, and I got dropped off, and my Jeep sitting out there with the golf bag in it, with the bag in it, with the stuff in it, and I thought about it. We got back really late at night. I didn't even go to my Jeep, you know. I went in, slept that night. The next morning, I think, was actually Christmas Day, and I got up that morning, and I was going to a meeting at an AA clubhouse, and then I was going to get my kids. You know, I hadn't seen my kids, and I was at this meeting, and there was a guy who was sharing. It was like a half speaker, half open discussion, and I could tell this guy had been sober a long time. By the end of that meeting, I was getting ready to go get my kids. That's when I finally really gave it up, you know, because I decided I'm not going to drive with my kids in the car and with any more dope in the car. You know, I'm not going to do that. And I learned here that what I needed to do was go find somebody to help me get rid of it. And that's what I did. I grabbed the guy who spoke, and he took the stuff and you know, he didn't even want to throw it in the dumpster at the AA clubhouse, you know, but he took it away and disposed of it. And I got his number, and I've talked to him a few times over the years, you know, and he doesn't remember me really, but I remember him. And that's when I really said goodbye, you know, to it. It was pretty powerful, pretty powerful. I went and got my kids, and I came back, and I forgot to tell the Phil story. Phil and I are buddies, we've been buddies, and he said, like, day two I was here, he looks across the room, and he's like, Greg, you see that guy over there? We were in the spirituality meeting, okay? He said, look at that guy, the new guy over there, his head's about to blow up, you know? It's like... I was so pissed off. It was like, when are you going to get to the spirituality part? You know, and I didn't realize the whole thing was about spirituality. You know, we were in it. We were in it and living it. And I didn't know. I didn't know. But I came back to Ridgeview, and I told them about that stash I had and what I had done, and they were very interested in the whole process and how I was thinking about that. And while I was there, one of the lobbyists who I used to drink with while I was home for Christmas died from alcohol-related, something bust in him. And and he died, and I just thought, and I was there sober, you know, and it was just very, very ironic. But when I got out, I did go home, and Bill mentioned I did what they told me to do. You know, I drove from here straight to an AA clubhouse in Nashville. I called the AA central office on my way into town. There's a meeting, it was like 6 o'clock. They said there's a 6:30 meeting down here. It's called the Lifesavers Group. Went down to the to the place and went to the meeting, and I, you know, I was like, I remember asking Bob, Jane, I was like, you know, should I get a sponsor who's like, you know, a father figure, or, you know, another lawyer, or, you know, what should I do? They said, you know, Tony, you'd probably be good with somebody like a biker, you know, and I was like, yeah, you know, that sounds good to me. And I remember going to that meeting and I shared, and after I shared, you know, I was crying. It was like I was just home. I had about 60 something days, you know, I guess, and I put my head down, and this guy spoke up, and he was quoting Bill W., and he was speaking the truth, you know, and I looked up, you know, and he's got a beard down to here and hair down to here, and I went up to him afterwards. I asked him to be my temporary sponsor, because that's all we have to do, and he was my temporary sponsor for 2 years, and his name is Joe. He's still sober today. And I worked the steps with him. I want to share a couple of things about, you know, what it's like now, what it's been like sober, especially for the new folks. So I apologize if I go over a few minutes. But when we got going on the steps, you know, and I mean, I remember too, I'll just share this. I know Laura's here somewhere from the Tennessee Lawyers Assistance Program. The thing that pissed me off about my intervention was I got in there, my family was there, there was this counselor there who was like leading the thing, and then there was this other guy sitting over here, his name's Robert, and like, this is Robert with the Lawyers Assistance Program. And I just was, you know, I was just, it was a good thing that they did, you know, but it just pissed me off because I didn't have any problems with the lawyers, you know, I hadn't done anything wrong. I mean, other than throwing eight balls through the window at McDonald's, you know, on my way to the office or something, that was just, but Robert is still a good friend of mine today. And I remember calling Robert after my fourth step marathon and fifth step, and I said, Robert, you know, I just finished my fifth step today. And he said, congratulations, man. He said, you wouldn't believe how many people never do that. And I just paused. I couldn't believe it. You know, I was like, you're kidding. You know, he's like, no. I thought everybody did a fourth step and a fifth step. And he made me realize then that, you know, a lot of people don't ever do that. And I like to remember that, you know, because I don't think we can stay sober without it. But when I got to the ninth step, I want to share one amends story that was something that I walked around with for a long, long time. When I was 22 years old, I slept with a friend of mine's girlfriend at the time, and while he was out of town, and they were both a little older than me. Long story short, she turned up pregnant, called me and told me it was mine, not to worry about it. Alan was going to marry her. Alan thought it was his. And that never asked me for a thing, never wanted a thing from me. And you know, kind of like shocked me, scared me. I went and got numb, I'm sure, about it. And I stuffed that from 22 years old until, I guess, 41 when I was doing my amends. And by this time, she was 18. And when I got, you know, when I heard about the amends, you know, and I saw the what you had to do, I knew that would be on my list. And I had feared this for a long time. You know, I would run into this woman, and she would tell me about her daughter and how she was doing and what she was doing in school and all that. And I was married at the time with kids, and I would just kind of freak out and like, oh my God, you know, this can't be happening. I got to get away from her, you know, and forget this again, just stuff it. And the whole time, you know, based on my kind of childhood and needing that fatherly figure around, you know, I've turned into an overly father figure. You know, I overdo it sometimes, but you know, that part was really hard for me. And long story short, I worked with my sponsor closely on that, and he said, you know, you should do whatever she wants to do, the girl, we'll just call her Susie, whatever she wants to do. She's 18, it's her choice. So I talked to her mom, and she decided, and she had been told that I was her father. You know, I came to find out. And anyway, the girl wanted to meet me, and I wanted to meet her. And we met one morning. We decided we were going to meet, and we had breakfast, and we talked. And, you know, I was trying to figure out how I was going to integrate this young lady into my life. And we went over to a DNA testing place, and we had DNA tests done, and it took a few weeks to get it back. And I remember I got the call, and I went by and picked up the results, and it turns out that I wasn't her father. And you know, it was very relieving and very disappointing at the same time. But I'd carried so much fear around for so many years about that. And it just goes to show you, you know, that fear is like a mile high and a mile wide, but it's just like this thin, you know, and you just kind of have to walk through it. And it all worked out, you know. I think we were both a little disappointed, but I hope she's well today. You know, I hate now that I've been sober this long, going to meetings, somebody brings up a topic or a problem, and these old-timers, you know, sometimes will start spewing the gospel of AA, you know, and this is my experience in some of my meetings. I never hear them talk about their difficulties. And I really appreciate it when somebody who I know has been around longer than me talks about something painful that's going on with them. Because I still need to hear that, you know, and how they're staying sober one day at a time. And I'm just here to tell you that you know, my life is like everybody else's, you know. It's still life, and there's many parts that are very difficult, and many parts that are very good, but I still have been doing some therapy off and on over the years. If I've got to take a medicine, I still call an addictionologist. I have a home group where, you know, I know them, they know me. We go to dinner once a week after the meeting. I got a sponsor. I got a sponsee who just, you know, one of the rare ones that does what you ask him to do. And he's been sober about a year and a half now. Picked up his 1 year chip not too long ago. You know, after I got sober too, I went in to do a physical and all that. And they had some new tests out that were more thorough. My hepatitis C gone. I can only credit that to trying to live a clean life and what the higher power can do. After about a year sober, I had done my amends with my sister. She relapsed, overdosed, and died at the age of 38, left behind a husband and a little 5-year-old boy. And I was there, with her and with my mother and father and brother and I was full of AA then. I'd been sober about a year and a half, I guess, and I remember my parents individually telling me things like, when I would talk to them about their pain, and they would tell me things like, how'd you get so wise, and it's stuff I learned in AA. And it's that intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. I recently read, I was down here one time, met a guy from Nashville, a young lawyer. He turned out to be a sponsee of mine when we got back to town. And I don't know what happened to him for a long time, but I recently read in one of the bar journals that he was arrested and he had pled guilty to, aggravated burglary, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Law license gone. I don't know if he's in jail or what, but, when something like that happens, I just like, but for the grace of God, go I. But one of my favorite things is, being a dad. And I have to say that when things do get difficult and when things are painful, I still want to change the way I feel. I still do. I've been struggling with the whole food thing for years, it's back to that simple thing for me, and that is just don't pick up. It will pass. This too shall pass. And a lot of times, maybe I'm supposed to pray and ask God to remove the desire, but most times I think about my kids. And it's just not an option. Not an option. So today the latest theory for me, the concept that I'm trying to apply in my life with some things I have going on is to thine own self be true. And I'm trying to figure out just what that is, But I'm not doing it alone. I'm talking to my friends and men in the program and therapists and people I know and respect and that know me and know a little bit about me. That's the concept that I'm trying to apply today. And I never thought I'd be 50. Never thought I'd get to 20 or 30. But to be 50, is amazing. Now I don't want to die, I don't want to have that heart attack that I've always feared having. Because hopefully, I'm only halfway through and I am amazed being halfway through. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Tony.